Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening. If you're in Chicago, it's probably cocktail time. It's a real pleasure to do an event for the first time with Dr. Ian K. Smith, whose book, The Overnights, his third Ash Kane mystery, I'm holding in my hand. I've actually read the first two Ash Kane mysteries. Chuck, I remember Dr. Smith, am I right? Should I call you Ian? Dr. Smith seems a little formal.
Ian is great. I love Ian.
Okay, we'll do Ian. Were they? They came from a different publisher? Do I remember this right?
And yes.
Two backs from the Amazon?
Yes. So Amazon published the first two. They published them in trade paper, but also hardcover on demand. So that's kind of the Amazon system. So you could get either hardcover or paperback, or you can get the audio.
Right. Well, I'm sure I remember reading them. And of course, I was attracted for reasons that will become clear in a moment to a book about Chicago. So, but let me introduce Dr. Smith because he has this really dazzling resume. Number one, New York Times bestselling author of Shred, the Revolutionary Diet, as well as Super Shred, the Big Results Diet, Blast the Sugar Out, the Clean 20, and 20 other books with millions of copies in print. And really, I should be talking to him about his health books, but we're here to talk about the Ash Kane mysteries. His first two novels were The Blackbird Papers and The Ancient Nine, and then, as I mentioned, two earlier books in this Ash Kane series, The Unspoken and Wolf Point. Dr. Smith's a graduate of Harvard, Columbia University of Chicago. So why are we doing this on June 16th? Well, I mean, sorry, 19th. There are various reasons. And if you don't mind, Ian, I'm going to delve back into a little personal history here. I grew up in Winnetka. I was born in 1940. And at that time, Chicago was a mixed cultural city, but it was almost all European. It was the largest Polish city in the world.
Hey, Barbara, just quickly before you keep going, just so the sound is a little bit better, can you bring your phone
closer to my phone?
A little bit closer. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. This is all, I'm apologizing to all of you because for some reason I'm suddenly on my phone because my computer died.
That's a little bit better.
Okay, is that better? All right. So anyway, back to New Tour High School and all of that. My Chicago was very white, very European. And the North Side and the North Shore was really the part that I was familiar with. Strangely enough, the South Side was not a great area at that time. But what's interesting, Ian, is that I grew up to marry Julius Rosenwald's great-grandson. And the Chicago of the Museum of Science and Industry, known to me as the Rosenwald Museum, Ravinia, the family summer home, the Adler Planetarium, a Rosenwald brother-in-law, and so forth. All of these landmarks I have revisited. But the part that I never knew anything about, which you might know something about, are the Rosenwald schools, which were not in Chicago, but in fact, all across Black communities in the South. And the wonderful work that Julius Rosenwald did in Chicago with the YMCA and other institutions. Are you familiar with any of that?
I am familiar with some of the history, for sure. The South Side, which you said that you're not familiar with, has a very interesting history in Chicago. In fact, the whole city of Chicago is actually very interesting. You know, when you really talk about kind of like, as you say, it was a very European city. And then there was a huge influx of African-Americans from the South during the Great Migration. And the Southerners, the African-American Southerners, settled mostly on the South Side. For those who've not been to Chicago, and I've lived in many other cities, fortunately. Chicago is a very segregated city. And what I mean by that is that geographically and ethnically, everyone has kind of a carve out. And I didn't know that the history behind that was until someone told me about old Mayor Daley really had devised the transportation system to keep the city segregated, to keep people in their own areas, which I think is very sad. My wife's grandfather, who just passed last year, who lived to be 100, he lived on the South Side of Chicago, for example. He had maybe been to the North Side of Chicago 10 minutes from his house, maybe five times in his whole life. And I was amazed by that. Like, how could you live in a city like this and not have gone, you know, 10 minutes away from your house only five times in 80 something years? So it's a very interesting city. And that's why in the Overnights and the other Ash Kane novels, that's why Chicago is a character in the book, because I think Chicago is a fascinating city. It has all the things that you want in a city. It has the good, the bad, the ugly. It has sports teams. It has restaurants. It has neighborhoods. It has corruption. That is the core of Chicago, as I say in the book. And so I just think that Chicago is a great backdrop, not just historically, but where it is now.
Oh, I totally agree with you. And I was fascinated. For me, your books are kind of a tour of a Chicago that I don't know, because I left to go to Stanford in 1958. And while I went back to Northwestern for a couple of years, I really have never gone back and lived there. But you will gather from what I was mentioning about the Rosenwalds that there was serious money. Back then, a millionaire was like a billionaire. But what was interesting is we went back to I think an anniversary of the Museum of Science and Industry. And I realized that all of those Rosenwald people, all that money, they lived on the South Side. Those homes are available to tour on the South Side. And I thought, how did that happen? That, you know, Julius died in the 1930s. So, and I was born in 19, so let's say in 25 years, the South Side became a place my parents wouldn't let me go because it was too dangerous. And yet it had been the fabulously wealthy part of Chicago. And I'm amazed it happened that quickly.
Well, the South Side, the near South Side, so there's near South Side and deep South Side. The near South Side, which you're referencing, actually served as kind of the weekend getaway for wealthy Chicagoans who lived downtown in the North Side. And so they would take their horse and buggy, and they would go to the South Side, and they had weekend homes near the lake, and they'd spend the weekends there. So it was a place of great affluence early in the years. And then immigration happened, migration happened, and all these kinds of things happened that changed the milieu of the South Side. And by the way, there was a time, and there now has been a resurgence, where the upper class African-Americans of the city lived in very important pockets of the South Side, like Brownsville, where our main character grew up. So he grew up in Brownsville, which is just south of the South Loop. And that was an area of doctors and lawyers and educators and professors. So it's interesting how the city has had this kind of evolving transformation in the demographics and the geography of the city. It's been very interesting.
Now, this is not something that has come up in your book, and I really was fascinated learning about Brownsville, for example, which I never heard. You know, this damn computer is just booted up, so I may transfer here in a minute. But the differences, the divides, when I was a child on the North Shore of Chicago, were religious. Neutra High School, which was a fabulous school, still is, we were almost equally into thirds between Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish. And those were the lines that I had to navigate as a child and as a teenager, were those religious differences, not racial differences, because there really wasn't any mixed race on the North Shore anyway at that time. So, you know, I find it so interesting to go back and read your books and realize, you know, there's a whole new history here that and places and so forth that I don't know anything about. And I like the way you brought the city and those landmarks and those neighborhoods and so forth into play. My other question is, because at the heart of this story is a very ambitious woman whose interest is keeping up her readings in her world. How important is television still in the city of Chicago? I mean, are we, you know, it seems to me that the digital world and all is gradually taking television, just like newspapers, kind of out of reality. But of course, the first television I think that I can remember came into our neighborhood in Winnetka when it was like maybe 1950, 1948. So I remember life before television, but I'm now wondering if at the end of my life, as you can gather, I'm 82, and whether I'm going to see life once again without television. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. So you're correct. The overnights, let me just kind of segue into the title and connect it to what you're just saying. So the overnights is called the overnights because it's about a ratings war between two major anchor women in Chicago who are prime anchors. Morgan Shaw is the number one evening anchor. She's glamorous, she's tough, and she's determined to remain number one. And the overnights in TV world is when there are four periods throughout the year that are called sweeps. They're ratings periods. And that's when the outside companies look at the ratings to see who's number one, two, three, four, whatever it is. And then they base their advertising rates, how much they charge for advertising, based on where they fall. So these periods that are called sweeps are extremely important in the TV world. So in this particular novel, Morgan Shaw, the prime evening anchor, is trying to hold on to her number one spot during this ratings period. And she's trying to uncover a great investigative piece about the shooting of an unarmed man in Chicago. And she believes that if she can get this story on air, that it would be very explosive, it would be very gripping to the city, and it would draw a lot of eyeballs and keep her at number one. So this is all about Chicago media, and the characters in the book are based on a lot of my friends who are evening anchor women and reporters in the city. To answer your question specifically about the importance of TV, particularly in Chicago, is when I went to medical school here, TV had a different impact and a different place in Chicago than it does now. And I'm sure this is in other cities. With so many other platforms, whether it's streaming services, whether it's social media, digital shows, and like we're streaming now, there's so many other platforms that the day and time when going and watching, for example, the evening news, which we did religiously, right? We would go to the evening news. It was stamped in our heads to watch the national news and the local news to find out what's going on. People don't have that kind of appointment TV watching anymore. People can go online, they're on their phones, they can get the headlines. So I think that, unfortunate for TV people, that the impact that TV has not only has diminished, but it's going to continue to diminish, no doubt about it.
Well, I think you're right. But I mean, the engine behind her, this story is her ambition. And I'm wondering, you know, if number one rating, in fact, is anything that, you know, is going to matter a lot, because as you say, the multiplicity of platforms. I mean, I remember, you know, gathering to watch Walter Cronkite, and, you know, nobody ever suggested fake news. I mean, you know, it didn't even come up. We all thought that he was completely reliable. In fact, we have the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism here in Phoenix. And, you know, my father went to the Medill School of Journalism in Northwestern. That was his undergraduate degree at Northwestern. And, you know, I guess the challenge is a crime writer. And one of the things I love about mystery or crime fiction, as I usually call it, is that in the words of somebody, maybe even Sarah Paretsky, who's the other Chicago, best known Chicago crime writer, is that it cuts along the edge of social change. So crime writers always seem to have their antenna out, you know, looking for conflict, looking for, you know, crimes, trying to disable technology in order to, you know, actually do any investigating enough. But, you know, you have to change not with society, but almost ahead of society in order to make your books work. Otherwise, they're going to be dated so quickly.
You know, I am always thinking of stories. I love the genre of crime fiction. I watch it and I read it and I listen to it. So my wife says, can you listen or watch anything else in your life? And the answer is yes, golf. But no, I love the genre. It's very intriguing to me. And I think it resonates with me because I am naturally a curious person. And part of writing investigative works or crime fiction, part of it is trying to find the clues and put the clues together, and it constantly makes you think. And so I think that crime writers, our minds are always on overdrive. Like I could be sitting at, you know, a recital And I could see something. I could see the way a particular person is dressed, or someone arrives late into the auditorium, and my mind thinks, geez, what a way to open up a story, that someone walks in late and is only noticed to be late by one person. And it's that one person that they need to find who remembers that this person arrived 15 minutes after the performance started. So, crime writers are always just thinking. And I think that's the fun of it. I mean, there are endless stories. I wish I could kind of genetically copy myself so I could write more stories, because I have more stories, unfortunately, I will ever be able to write because I'm just always thinking about
it. Right. Well, what if is the motivating question for all crime writers? They think people who are really maybe all novelists, but you know, where other people accept things, they think that crime writers are going, but what if? So anyway, Ash Kane, one of the things that I loved about this book, one of the many things I loved about this book, is that Ash Kane is a golfer. Now we know that the author is, but I sort of knew that. There's a ticking clock, at least in the front part of this book, which means that he's trying to shoulder his way through whatever he has to do in order to come out for a long golf break in Scottsdale, Arizona. Wow. And you really do a nice job. I mean, it's like a plug for Arizona. Chicago's climate, it's not the best. I remember before air conditioning, so let me tell you. and it was seriously cold. They once closed our school, Seneca, when it was, 22 degrees below zero for a week. And there wasn't any way for the heat to keep up. We walked to school in our snowsuit, even in that winter. But, yes. Here we go. So Ash is trying to get away from Chicago to work on his golf game here in Arizona. And it was clear to me that you must have been here, or are you just imagining how great it is to play golf in Scottsdale?
No, I've been to Scottsdale a couple of times, been to Arizona several times. And because I am an avid golfer, Arizona is a golf haven, particularly for us who live in very cold climates. So Arizona has some of the most famous golf courses in the country. And Ash Kane is an avid golfer. And, Ash Kane was a former detective with the Chicago Police Department. He left the department because he wouldn't participate in a cover-up. And so his morals said, I am not going to participate. I'm leaving the department. But Ash is a fighter for justice. And so he decides to hang up his own shingle to be a private investigator. And he got a nice settlement from the city. So money is not his imperative. And so he only takes on cases in and around the city that really interest him. That's it. He turns down more cases than he accepts. And in this particular instance, he actually says to Morgan Shaw, despite how famous and glamorous she is, I don't want to take this case. You want to hire me to be your bodyguard? Someone's stalking you, harassing you? That's not the kind of work I do. Well, eventually he gets and takes the case, but he still is saying, I've got to get to Arizona, okay? Yeah. I need to get my golf handicap together. This has been on the books. I got to get out of here. And I won't give too much of the story away, but he's determined to get to Arizona, but he's also determined to figure out what's going on with this prime evening anchor woman. So he's juggling both mandates, which makes it for a very, an interesting journey for him and for the readers to try to follow.
Well, this is like spoiler, but I have to say that part of the book, I was concerned that the whole point of the book was he wouldn't get to Arizona because, that could really happen. But fortunately he does. And I have to say that his accommodations in Arizona are particularly glamorous and not available for the ordinary person, but that's okay. So the other two things that are really defining Ash, aside from his work ethic and all, are A, his relationship with his father. We crossed back to yesterday, but his father, a noted psychiatrist, and Ash have a definitely difficult relationship, which Ash is always trying to bridge. And then his romantic life has suffered a terrible hit in an earlier book, and that has not been resolved. And I don't want to spoil anything, but is part of the way you can introduce conflict or define character to have somebody trying to figure out his personal life and what happens if somebody just leaves you?
Yes, absolutely. So I believe that people want heroes that they can root for, but they also want imperfect heroes. Nobody wants a guy who has it all, who's smart, who's handsome, solves all the cases, can beat 10 guys at once, gets all the pretty women. Nobody wants that guy. You want a guy who has some of those attributes, which Ash does have. But Ash also, as you have very well pointed out, Ash fails in relationships. That is one of his flaws or weaknesses, but he is not good in relationships. So he's struggling to mend fences with his dad. He and his dad, they don't hate each other, but they've had a very cold, distant relationship. And now that the mother is gone, Ash would like a relationship with his dad. And so he's working hard on that. But as you know, it's not a smooth road. The other part is the romance. For a guy who's handsome and smart and well, you know, well-heeled in the sense of he's, you know, well taken care of, he has problems with romance. And he got jilted at the altar and he's not recovered. So here's this guy, very macho, very tough kind of guy in many ways, but he's also very vulnerable when it comes to romance. And I want to create a character that people say, geez, I can feel for this guy. I can relate to this guy. I think heroes that are superheroes, they're just not relatable. And those aren't the kind of heroes I like to read. So when I'm reading crime fiction myself, I like guys who have flaws, who have challenges, who have issues, but still find a way to work through all that and come out on top. And that's what I hope I've created with Ash Kane.
I think you have. I mean, you know, there's the classic hero along these lines, not even cops, but certainly with private investigators, which basically Ash is to give them a flaw. Most of them are in the older ones, you know, they were alcoholics or, you know, I mean, just, and he kept wanting to say to them, get it together. And so Ash, you don't have to say to him, get it together in terms of how he's functioning as a sleuth, but you do hope for him that he'll get it together. But it's not all his fault. I mean, the thing is, you know, his dad is a real problem. The woman who left him is a big problem. So we can't just say that he's stunted or, you know, whatever. And it's easier to sympathize with somebody, I think, who's trying to sort things out where at least the responsibility is shared. And he's not just some shit, you know, that everybody wants to, you know, the woman in this story is the shit, let's face it. You know, she, Morgan, is the one that it's very hard to like. You can admire her. You can think she, you know, is a success and whatever, but it's pretty hard to like anybody that focused. And her attitude to sex, as you point out in the book, is pretty much, you know, just utilitarian.
Listen, Morgan Shaw is a glamorous number one primetime anchor woman. Morgan Shaw is about Morgan Shaw, period. Mm-hmm. Her world, her sun rises and it sets on herself.
Yep.
And to be honest with you, I've met many people like this in the TV world, believe it or not, who really become disconnected from the real world. And they're so consumed by their fame and their star power that that's only as far as they can see. And so I really wanted to draw this character that I've known in many different ways. I wanted to draw this character of someone who is so focused on being the best and sitting on that throne, that media throne, that she will do anything, she will say anything, she will use anybody she needs to be able to get what she wants. And fortunately or unfortunately, a lot of people in the TV world are like that. And names that you know that I will not repeat, but there are a lot of names that people watch on TV who are very similar to Morgan Shaw.
You know, sadly, it's not just people on TV. And, you know, we see a fair number of celebrities in the work we do. I counted out yesterday because I did an Instagram post for the store. I'm talking to 14 authors, starting with you, between now and Sunday. A couple of them are superstars, and some of them are lesser known. And I try to treat everyone exactly the same. You know, for me, it's about the book. It's not who the person is or whatever it is. And I turned down surprising number of things because I don't like the quality of the work. But what we've noticed over the years, and Patrick, you can come back in and speak to this, is that celebritydom puts people in a bubble. Because what happens is, if you kind of lose control of your immediate universe because you're so famous and people want stuff, you have to hire people. And their jobs are dependent upon becoming the communication channel. So gradually, the celebrity becomes more and more isolated within this bubble and only hears what people, think they want to hear. We've certainly seen this in at least one politician that we are not going to discuss, but nonetheless, a classic. So, I don't think Morgan's that unusual. I think there are a lot of people like her. The real tragedy is at some point, although look how long Barbara Walters went. I mean, who knew? It used to be that women were completely disposable over 40. Here I am, twice that age and still going strong. But I think that the longer life that women have today is great. But I also think it makes women more nervous. And, men could go on. Walter Cronkite could have kept on doing the news until he died. And everybody would have thought he was just aging more gracefully, but it's much harder for women, much harder.
Well, I actually knew Barbara Walters and had wonderful conversations with Barbara Walters when I was on The View. Barbara Walters was awesome to be around. She was smart. She was inquisitive. She liked to gossip. She was historical. She had such great historical context. She was so much fun. And Barbara Walters defied the odds for women because, as you've said, a man can age and stay in the chair until he wants to leave or something bad happens. A woman, unfortunately, according to the bosses, they age her out, which is ridiculous. But Barbara Walters had that kind of staying power. There was something, she wasn't like this beautiful blonde. She was just a great journalist, and she had this charisma to her. Like, you wanted to talk to Barbara Walters, you just did. But what I find interesting is that when you talk about celebrities who are in a bubble, I know a lot of celebrities, given the work that I do, and you're absolutely correct, that celebrities, unfortunately, start surrounding themselves with people who are making their living off of satisfying the celebrity. So, I have celebrity friends, for example, acquaintances also, who I say, who is surrounding this guy? Why is someone not telling him, you can't do this? This is not good for you. Well, the answer is that everyone is eating off of his table. And so they don't want to give up their spot at the table. And so you have these celebrities who are kind of orbiting in this bubble and completely disconnected. And it's actually, I know they have a lot of money. I know they're famous, but it's really sad when you think about the whole entirety of it, because they're kind of leading a false life in a way. And people are really fake around them. And so, I don't know. I think I would never want to be a celebrity at that level where I was disconnected from the reality of life or just doing things for myself. I mean, I just think that's life. Life has real texture to it. And by the way, that's why I like about Ash Kane is that Ash Kane has a lot of reasons why he could be up in the clouds, but he's not. Ash Kane, appreciates life. He appreciates the texture of life. And that's just kind of the kind of guy he is. He likes beautiful things, but he has no problem. Like, he'll go to the North Side and play golf with Penny, who's a billionaire. But the same token, he can go to the South Side and go into the, tough neighborhoods and feel just at home. He feels at home wherever he is.
He really does. I think people that don't get instant celebrity, that people who work to earn it, do better. They stay more grounded. And Ash, after all, did have, as you point out, a successful career as a cop until, we hit his moral threshold. And now he is. So, he doesn't have anything to prove. And I wish I could talk about the end of this book, but let's just say that celebrity also has its own protective power. So, there's an interesting moral lesson, and I feel like it's going to carry over into your next book. So let me wind up by asking you, as I try to, is there going to be another Ash King?
Is there going to be another? Absolutely. It's already written. Yeah, it's called Eagle Rock. And my hope is to write many, many Ash Kanes. And then I would like to do a spinoff and write some books on Mechanic, who's Ash Kane's right-hand man. A lot of people love Mechanic. And they've asked me, you know, write, we want more scenes with Mechanic. Mechanic's this tough Lithuanian guy who speaks very little with his words, but speaks a lot with his fists and his guns. But so the hope is to have many, many Ash Kanes, and then eventually also start writing the new character with his own series, Mechanic. So yes, it's already done. In fact, the next two books are done. The pandemic has been very good to me in that respect, that I've had a lot of time to write. That's one of the good things that came out of the pandemic. So I wrote a lot. And so, yeah, I'm working on the book for 2027, I think, now.
Wow, they're taking a long time. Well, am I right that there's going to be an echo from this book in a future book?
Say that again? Sorry.
There's going to be an echo from the way this book plays out in a future book.
Yes, the ending is very interesting. And I didn't know the ending before I started writing it. And then as I started writing, I realized this had to be the ending. And the ending means that there will be some future involvement related to this book. I won't give it away, but there'll be some future involvement down the road. Absolutely.
Yep. No, there really had to be. So, Patrick, why don't you come back from wherever you're working? You know, I'm wondering, is this really okay? Because you could disconnect me and I could now sign in. But are we okay like we are, just to finish up?
Patrick? I think we're good. Yeah, I think we're good, Barbara.
All right. We won't do all that. So are there any questions from the audience?
Yeah. There are a few questions about your best-selling nonfiction work about, you know, health and wellness. And you published, I was looking at some of the titles, you know, The Shred Diet, The Super Shred Diet, The Clean 20. I wanted to ask you about that. And I don't know, do you see your first published work was nonfiction, right? But it was only a couple of years before you published your first novel. How do the two different, do they inform each other in strange ways that people might not be aware of? Like how is your nonfiction, or maybe your whole philosophy about health and wellness, does it leak over into your fiction in any way?
I think the part that leaks over is my process. So I like research. And as Barbara pointed out, when you read my Ash Kane novels, it's really a roadmap to Chicago. And it really teaches you about the city, not in an overly didactic way. I'm not sitting on a soapbox preaching to you, but I want you to feel and smell and hear the city and its history. And so the way I research my nonfiction, my health and wellness books, is the same way I approach my novels. Novelists have the freedom, by the way, to research nothing. Novelists can sit down to a computer and just write whatever they want and make up whatever they want. For me, I like the idea of figuring out a story idea and then research, whether it's researching the location, researching the history of something. There are a lot of quotes. Ash Kane likes to drop a lot of quotes, whether they be Shakespearean or other literary figures or rap artists. And I'm researching that all the time. Does this quote fit? What does it really mean? So I think the connection between my nonfiction and fiction is the way I approach putting research into it. Now, obviously with fiction, I'm able to take that research and then kind of go off to where I want to go. But the foundation of my books are research. Sometimes they're medical issues. That's all part of, those are real things. I didn't just kind of make up some sci-fi kind of medical issue. It's all based in research and reality. So I think that's the biggest bridge between my nonfiction and my fiction.
However, let me just add that Ash Kane is sort of an exemplar of clean living in that, you know, we've already talked about golf and how fit he stays, but there are restaurant scenes because you can't do Chicago without talking about restaurants and food. So, you know, he's not crunching down Doritos with, you know, a couple of beers or something. It's much more elegant than that. So I think it carries over a little bit that way too.
Well, can I also add to that and say that a lot of comments I get from readers who like the books, they say, geez, I read your book, I'm so hungry. Because the way you describe the food, where he goes to eat, like, it's wonderful. And yes, you're right. Ash eats more like I do. I'm not a Doritos or chips kind of guy. I'm not perfect, by the way. And Ash also will take part in things like maybe a deep dish, maybe what we call in Chicago, Italian beef. So he does eat those things. But by and large, he's eating salads and fish. He runs a lot around the lake. He's a really healthy guy. He boxes a lot. So he's a really healthy guy. And so kind of, I guess people have said, Ian, some of your beliefs and how we should treat ourselves and our bodies, you have put into your character. And part of that is absolutely true.
Well, it's so important to remember that Chicago, I mean, there's a scene in the book where two of them meet up at one of the beach parking lots. And, you know, Chicago, it took me forever to reorient myself. When I went to Stanford, my whole world was water on the east, right? Because I grew up on Lake Michigan from Winnetka. I could never get the Pacific right. I was just never able to orient myself to water on the west. But, you know, Chicago, one of the most beautiful things about Chicago is Lakeshore Drive. I mean, Chicago really has done this magnificent job of, you know, stringing its way along the shores of Lake Michigan. Chicago actually means in Indian, place of the pig. And it's built on mud. So, you know, Chicago is actually vulnerable to if the lakes really rise. Just because it's in the middle of the country doesn't mean that it's not going to have a water problem. But, you know, I love the fact that you incorporated, you know, the lake and the beach and so forth in the story.
The Lakeshore Drive, which is our road that runs all the way from the north down south along the rim of the lake, and the city downtown is built on the lake. It is the, and I've been to many major cities in our country. Chicago is the prettiest city built literally on the lake. I mean, it is absolutely, and when you're driving towards the city, I was just coming home from St. Louis, for example, from the south. So I was driving north home to Chicago. And when you reach a point that you can see the skyline in the distance, it's just absolutely beautiful. And I love New York, I'm a New Yorker, but the skyline of Chicago and the way it's built against the water, I think is unparalleled, it really is.
Patrick?
Yeah, well, can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the writers in the genre that have influenced you or inspired you?
Sure, so, some of the usual suspects, you know, Michael Connelly, you know, I love Harry Bosch. I've been reading him for a long, long time, by the way, before he became Michael Connelly, I'd like to say. Lee Child, you know, I was reading Lee Child when he had all those paperback books with the concentric circles on it. That was like his cover. They were horrible covers, but the books were so good. I met him at a BEA one year, and someone said, we had a mutual friend, and he said, you should try reading this guy's book. Loved it. Another guy, he doesn't necessarily write crime fiction. It's hard to say what he writes, more thriller-esque, but Harlan Coben is a very good friend of mine. Harlan and I met one Christmas. Brian Gumbel from NBC Today Show had invited me to a Christmas party. And he said to me, hey, I want you to meet a friend of mine. And I thought, oh, it's going to be another stuffy kind of Christmas party with a bunch of celebrity media people. But I got excited because he said, there's going to be a writer there. And I really wanted to write fiction. And he said, there's a writer there who's a good friend of mine. His name is Harlan Coben. I never heard of him. And so I meet this guy, this 6'4 dude, and we hit it right off. And the guy says to me, Harlan says to me, hey, listen, I'll send you one of my first books. I said, no problem. The very next day, I was working at NBC News at the time, so I was working at 30 Rock on the Dateline floor. The very next day, the messenger, a courier, knocks on my office in 30 Rock, and there's a package. And the package is from Harlan Coben the very next day. And it's this little book, paperback, yellow cover, called Tell No One. And I tell you, I closed my door and sat down on my couch and could not put that book down. And so Harlan has since become a good friend of mine and a good we were just bowling a few months ago over at Rachel Ray's rap party. I also want to say one more author, or two more authors, if you don't mind, that Dominic Dunn, by the way, who is not a thriller writer, but Dominic Dunn was one of my favorite authors. Dominic Dunn, to me, really wrote crime fiction. And I'm sure you're familiar with all of his work. But Dominic Dunn was a tremendous writer. And even though he was a nonfiction writer in many respects, he also was a fiction writer because he took a lot of true stories and fictionalized them, like the two Mrs. Grenvilles, you know? So I think those guys influenced me a lot. Walter Mosley and his Easy Rollins mysteries, his early work was very good. So those are the guys. Oh, and I like Dennis Lehane also. I like to read Dennis. I don't think Dennis writes enough, by the way. I mean, everything he writes, I think, is wonderful.
Dennis wants to do screenplays. Dennis is, we did an event, we did his, not his lunch, but we did an event with him in April. And he spent quite a lot of time talking about why he likes writing for the movies. Part of it's time. He can spend more time with his family because he has a young family. But you're right, he doesn't write as often as we would all like him to. So you'd be glad to hear all of those people except Dominic Dunn hang out here at the Bend.
I got to come there sometime.
Well, I was thinking about that. Yeah, Michael Conley did his first ever event here. Lee did his first ever event here. Harl and I sat with him in a coffee shop while the auction was going on for Tell No One for the movie, right? So you can watch all of that on our website. For those of you watching this who don't know this, we've done maybe 1,050 by now streamed events in the last 3 years, and they're all available on our Facebook page. You don't have to belong to Facebook. You can just go to poisonpen.com and click on Facebook video, or you can watch them all on YouTube. So we're working on it. But anyway, it seems to me that an advantage of this conversation is that we should bring you here for a combination golf and book signing trip, right?
That's all you have to say. I'm ready to go. No argument from me.
Well,
let me ask you a question before you go. How many books do you have in your library?
How many books in this library? You know, that's a really interesting question. I suppose a couple thousand, but Patrick and I are engaged upon doing what we call, well, Patrick can tell you, it's sort of a resale book project for the bookstore. And I'm going to donate some of these. But the biggest problem I have is that most of them are inscribed to me, and people don't want a book that says, you know, to Barbara with love from Lee. You know, it's just, so I haven't quite worked out how we're going to do that. But I would like to keep, you know, evolving it. We'll see. The bookstore is sort of my real permanent library. So,
well, let me know. I'd like to buy some of them. Let me know.
You're so nice. Well, listen, hang on a minute after we sign off, because then I can tell you a couple of things. Patrick, is there anything else from the audience?
Has there been any film or TV interest in the Ash Kane books?
Yes. So we have, the Ash Kane books have been optioned for a streaming TV series. As you know, unfortunately, with the writer's strike, that has slowed us down. But we have already written the pilot script, and fingers crossed, once the writer's strike is over, we go back to work. I also wrote a novel called The Ancient Nine, which is based on my experiences in one of Harvard's secret society. I went to Harvard College, and I was in one of the clubs, and The Ancient Nine has also been optioned to become a streaming series. And I also wrote a book that has not even published yet, but it's been optioned, and it's a love story. It's an unorthodox love story called The Girl from Shepherd's Market. It takes place in London, Paris, and New York. I know. You're going to say, love story, you? Yes. Well, I love love stories too, by the way.
Shepherd's Market. I knew it was London the minute you said Shepherd's Market, where I have been. Great. Wonderful.
Yeah, so anyway, yes, there's been interest, and I hope people will follow me on Instagram at Dr. Ian Smith. Spell the doctor out, I-A-N Smith. On Facebook, I have a page called The Good Reading Room.
Yay, how wonderful. Well, I want to encourage all of you to look through the Ash Kane series. As we say, we have the first two books in paperback at the store, and now The Overnight, which came out on May 30th. And we will definitely sort out a way for Dr. Ian Smith to come to Scottsdale to play golf and talk books with his next book. Well, actually, so he has so many books coming, we have almost unparalleled opportunities here. Maybe when Michael Connelly comes in November, we can lure you out.
I know, I've met him before, by the way, so I would love to do that. I would love it.
Well, we'll see what we can work out. Lee doesn't tour anymore, but Harlan is here usually, and Michael's been here for all of his books, so that'd be fun. All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. And Patrick, you want to disconnect us?
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.